as a postscript to that text, if anyone is wondering what happened to verses 3 through 32, the whole chapter 19 of Leviticus begins with those words. The Lord spoke to Moses saying, essentially, you shall be holy because I'm holy, or you shall be holy like I am holy. And then the rest of the chapter is a series of commandments that the Israelites will follow in order to be holy. And it, towards the end of it, we get to those verses 33 and 34, but that's the context of the whole chapter. Our gospel reading comes from the first chapter of John, what's known as the prologue of John, verses 1 through 18. So listen again for the word of God. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through Him, and without Him not one thing came into being. What has come into being in Him was life, and the life was the light of all people. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to testify to the light so that all might believe through him. He himself was not the light, but he came to testify to the light. The true light, which enlightens everyone, was coming into the world. And he was in the world. And the world came into being through him. Yet the world did not know him. He came into his own, and his own did not receive him. But to all who received him, who believed in his name, he gave power to become children of God, who were born not of blood or of the will of the flesh or of the will of humans, but who were born of God. And the Word became flesh and lived among us. And we have seen his glory, the glory as of a Father's only Son, full of grace and truth. John testified to him and cried out, "This was he of whom I said, he who comes after me ranks ahead of me because he was before me. From his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. The law indeed was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. And no one has ever seen God. It is God, the only Son, who is close to the Father's heart, who has made him known." Truly, this is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. So I have a little confession. This is the first time I've done this here in this church, but this is a sermon that was actually preached a few years ago and has been reworked for the purposes of our current series. The original series that this sermon was preached in was entitled Modern Faith, and we were going through the entire Gospel of John and addressing topics that the church had some voice in that were contemporary topics of discussion. And in this case, we were right in the middle of a significant immigration debate in the state of Georgia. There was a piece of legislation on the books to be able to stop and ask people for their papers without any other reason to stop them. And so that was what was going on, I think, the next day when this sermon was originally preached. The passage that we had planned on using for our sermon series, Do Not Fear, is the Leviticus passage that you heard read. And so the sermon from John 1 is now kind of been reworked through the lens of that Leviticus passage. And there will be space for further conversation if folks are interested in the week following this. John is just a little bit different in how he goes about his task. When it comes to the cohort of gospel writers, John, without question, is an outsider. See, around the year 70, someone who we have come to call Mark decided that it would be important to write down the stories that were certainly being told around dinner tables, the stories that were getting believers in trouble in their synagogue, the stories of Jesus. In his haste to get words on paper, Mark begins his story with Jesus' baptism, calling it the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Sometime later, Matthew and Luke follow Mark's outline incredibly closely, but they aren't quite satisfied with Mark's starting point, and so they insert birth narratives, because surely the beginning of the good news of Jesus begins with the beginning of Jesus, with his birth. But even beyond that, Matthew and Luke both begin not in a delivery room, but they begin with genealogies. They begin with angelic announcements and with virginal conceptions. Before Jesus even really appears on the scene, the good news is anticipated in history. Those two different birth narratives, they don't exactly match up with one another, but that's okay because that's not their point. The point is that Jesus is a particularly unique and wonderful gift to the world, who has been given to us by the God of David, by the God of Abraham. Luke even takes Jesus' lineage all the way back to Adam, so that within human history, Matthew and Luke have covered just about every base that can be covered in telling the Jesus story. But then, some 30 years after Mark was written, John, the nonconformist that he is, decides to get creative and to start with a poem that is set outside of history, outside of existence as we know it. He begins, "In the beginning was the Word." This hearkening back to Genesis, "in the beginning," is actually John's way of saying, among other things, that the gospel has no beginning. It is eternal. It is as eternal as is God's self. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. This Word is the Word through which the entire created order was brought into existence. It is a fundamental theological claim that God is the Creator, and everything and everyone else is a creature. We are one form of existence. God is another. The Word is God, and so as a creature, we profess and proclaim that the Word is other. The Word is different than you are. The Word is foreign to me because I am not God. But the Word is. The point is about the same as that of Genesis 1, that there is a creator who is distinct from all creation. But John is not simply restating what has already been proclaimed. He's employing that which is familiar in order to introduce what is new, what is foreign. And so, continuing in his departure from the Synoptic Gospels, which can be a little bit unclear in regards to Jesus' divinity, John makes a scandalous move, and he identifies the uncreated eternal Word with a flesh and blood born of a woman creature. The Word became flesh, he says, and it lived among us, and that word "lived" is really tabernacled or pitched a tent. Getting a little poppy there. This is scandalous because in both Jewish monotheism and Greek philosophy, there's an understanding that God exists in an entirely different realm than does creation. God doesn't become anything, and certainly not flesh. God simply is. And God is in heaven, where the Greeks hope to finally be joined with him, having escaped from the flesh. The word "becoming flesh," then, is to co-opt the Apostle Paul's language. It is a stumbling block to the Jews. It is foolishness to the Greeks. It is a scandal. John will go on to name this eternal Word become mortal flesh as Jesus Christ, God the only Son. I had to double check that phrase when I was reading, because we're so used to reading God's only Son, but John's grammar here actually makes explicit what his poetry has been hinting at for 18 verses. Jesus of Nazareth, the first century Jewish man, is the Word become flesh, and the Word is God. So insofar as the Word is God, it is foreign to us, and so Jesus is foreign. Insofar as the Word is flesh, it is familiar, and so Jesus is familiar. John dives right into the paradox that scares the bejesus out of most of us without getting too caught up in trying to explain it. But this is the paradox of the incarnation, is that the uncreated creator came to live among the creatures as a creature. The singular resident of eternity has voluntarily moved into history. An immigrant is defined in the dictionary as a person who comes to live permanently in a foreign land. And I can't think of a better metaphor for the incarnation than that. Three little verses in the middle of John's prologue summarize the rest of his gospel. Even though the Word was in the world as an insider, a flesh and blood family member, even though the Word was in the world as one of us, we did not recognize Him. And in direct defiance of the commandments from Leviticus that we heard read this morning, we became afraid of Him. And out of our divine xenophobia, we made a conscious decision to send this particular foreigner back to where he came from. During His trial, Jesus says it Himself. He says, "I am not of the world." And yet He is in it. He created it. And interestingly enough, it is only His foreignness, that which gets Him nailed to a cross, that can redeem it. Now, assimilation was certainly a possibility. It likely would have saved Jesus' life, but as we all know, Jesus wasn't particularly concerned with saving Himself. I had this really nice outline written when I was first putting this sermon together. I got most of the way through it with the manuscript, and then I came to the point where I had planned to ground all of this kind of poetic, philosophical mumbo-jumbo with a story. In order to do what I thought this sermon was supposed to do, I needed a good, heartwarming story about a first-generation immigrant to this country. I imagined the possibilities. Maybe she did not speak English. Maybe he couldn't get work or was living on the streets. Maybe the other kids at school attacked him with racial slurs, the impact of which they could have never understood. Maybe they had come as a family but had been separated by a legal technicality. The possibilities go on and on because, as we know, these stories are real and there's no shortage of them. But they weren't working for me in this sermon. I couldn't bring myself to tell any of these stories because they aren't mine to tell. And I don't mean that to say that because I'm not one of the main characters, I shouldn't be allowed to tell it. I mean, I honestly don't know anyone for whom these stories are actually a reality. I don't have friends or even acquaintances who have these kinds of stories, at least none who have trusted me enough to share them. In Georgia, there are about 1 million immigrants. In the state of California, there are 10 million immigrants, 75% of whom are in this country legally and about 25% of whom are currently undocumented. Our town of Woodland is nearly 50% Latino-Latina. I have ordered food from these folks in local establishments. I have walked by them on the streets. But I've rarely ever gotten to know someone who was obviously a foreigner. The overwhelming majority of my non-white friends are at least second generation in this country, which means that they are fairly assimilated to American culture and fairly easy for me to relate to without encountering too much that challenges my way of life. In other words, if a person has become enough like me, then I can imagine and even engage in a relationship with that person. But if someone is wholly foreign, then as much as I hate to admit it, the possibility of becoming friends with that person typically doesn't even enter my mind. Now, I am aware of how self-condemning those words are. And in light of our passage this morning, it is difficult for me to speak them without a sense of guilt and loss. John's otherworldly poetry recognizes that the foreigner among us is not often seen for what he or she truly is, and my life could serve as kind of a proof text for that claim. In his article, Fear and Wisdom in the Immigration Debate, the professor Raj Nadella says of these foreigners among us, they have many labels: undocumented immigrants, illegal aliens, wetbacks. Jan Brewer, the governor of Arizona, has suggested that most of them are drug mules. And we might add in our current political season that the presidential candidate, Donald Trump, has recently called them rapists and killers. We have many labels for immigrants among us. But as Nadella points out, few of them are known by their real names. Few of them are treated as people with real lives. The alien who resides with you shall be to you as the citizen among you. You shall love the alien as yourself, for you were aliens in the land of Egypt. A person who comes to live permanently in a foreign land makes himself a foreigner. He came into the world, John says, but the world did not know him. He came into his own, but his own did not receive him. Just like me, he became flesh. I am flesh. Flesh is the realm in which I engage. I am flesh, but I am not word. And as John's story goes on to tell us, word is not welcome here. Word gets betrayed, arrested, tried, executed as a criminal. Though it is flesh, it is foreign. So what if we play it out in strictly human terms? I am flesh, but I am not brown. Brown is not welcome here. I am flesh, but I am not gay. Gay is not welcome here. I am flesh, but I am not Muslim. Muslim is not welcome here. I am flesh, but I am not different. I am normal. Different is not welcome here. We may tolerate different. We may legislate protection for different, but do we welcome different into our family? Do I welcome difference as flesh, or do I stereotype it as foreign? The incarnation demands that we welcome at least one who is foreign. And as John's story goes on to tell it, we couldn't even do that. The Word becomes flesh, and as verse 16 tells us, it is from His fullness that we may receive grace upon grace. It is from His fullness. And so I will leave us with a question. If we fail to welcome the fullness of flesh, all colors and contours, as children of God, as brothers and sisters in the human family, if we fail to welcome the fullness of human flesh without demanding that it assimilate to our likeness, can we still claim that we have welcomed the Word? Or will we have crucified it?